need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, he knows it was Julie Bowen all along. It's Andy Greenwald.
Great to see you. Great to be
man.
Here.
Great to see you too. We have a fun episode of The Watch today. Sadly, no Ethan Hawke, but you can't win them all. Today, we're talking about Donald Glover's new overall deal at Amazon and the latest episode of WandaVision, all coming up next on The Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
What's going on, man? How are you?
Well, I feel a little, first of all, thanks for asking. I appreciate it. I feel a little churlish because I was going to comment on the fact that it's 79 degrees and sunny here. Uh-huh. And I think we literally live in Westview because I think the rest of the country is suffering under truly terrible weather that I'm not even trying to make light of. And I feel remarkably privileged that we don't have that right now. My heart goes out to people, certainly in Texas, but everyone on the East Coast who's just getting dumped on. That's
yeah,
terrible.
I know. My mom is like, it's just like, it's never ending. It's like, it's up there with like 96. What was the year in the 80s that was just like the, like I built Hoth outside of my house?
You mean like in the, like the Wall Street yuppie day trader sense that it was snowing all the time?
Yeah,
in the
like in the we got it for cheap volume 2 sense that I built Hoth.
Like Jay McInerney was building Hoth? Near the West Side Highway, where the bread bakers are. I don't remember the specific year of our youth in which we built snowmen relatively near one another, no.
Not in the Jeezy sense.
No, I don't remember that.
Andy, there was a couple of news things I wanted to talk to you about before we did WandaVision, as we typically do on Mondays. First of all, did you watch anything cool this weekend? I like starting with this question.
Did I watch anything cool this weekend? No, it was a pretty not much screen time. Not much screen time this weekend.
Did you read? Did you?
I did. Yeah, I've been. Thanks. Thanks for.
I don't know. We're just talking. We're just two guys.
You're really poking around, and I appreciate it. I don't have anything new to report on my screen time this weekend. Did you watch anything cool?
Yeah, no, I checked out Behind Her Eyes, which I would like to talk about at length with someone. That is an erotic thriller on Netflix, starring Eve Hewson, who we love from The Nick, which is now streaming on HBO Max.
We're going to talk about that.
And we could talk about that. But Behind Her Eyes is quite a ride. And I finished The Head, which I wanted to not spoil for you, but I was going to, I can't tell if I want you to finish it or not.
Okay, well, let's unpack that piece by piece.
Okay.
Piece number one, Behind Her Eyes.
Yeah.
I Googled.
Don't spoil it because they're trying their hardest to spoil it for me on the internet.
But so you haven't finished?
No, I watched one episode.
Okay, so I won't spoil. I actually, you know, I know we had a long talk about you not wanting to be spoiled, but this I was like, I'm not going to be watching this. So I feel free. It's the same way
you're
feel
not
about
a big erotic thriller
movies.
Guy.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. So when you saw the log line, an erotic thriller.
I was thinking to myself, it's been a while since I tried one.
Okay.
You know, right. It's like this is a genre that in some ways was very formative for me and Andy growing up in the 90s.
Sure.
You couldn't throw a stone without hitting an erotic thriller, a Joe Esterhaz script steaming from the pure sexual tension between Michael Douglas and Sharon Stone, or William Baldwin and Sharon Stone.
you know how in, and this is another genre that is, a little bit underserved these days. But you know, there was the genre of like coming of age stories.
Sure.
Particularly. And like generally they would show like the young, generally, sad to say, the young man who would grow into our main character. You know, the one day that the neighbor took a shower with the window open or like went to the ice machine and cooled her brow and that fueled everything. I don't think you could do that for my relevant experience here, which was the time I went to Disney World with my friend Brian and his mom took us to see Basic Instinct in the theater. I haven't recovered.
Yeah.
But I guess in the scheme of things, just in terms of the psychological blast radius, I was clear of it. You know what I mean? Because it wasn't my mother. So
it was, I will say that the Behind Her Eyes has some pretty steamy sex scenes.
It's steamy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Whereas like normal people, it's like, I feel like normal sex. It's kind of like, that's what you, it's sort of like an extension of the two people trying to find one another and like find out who they are in the world. The sex in Behind Her Eyes so far has been of a different variety. So shout out to them. Shout out to Eve Husen.
Is it, what is that? It's on a boat? What do you like?
No, it just seems to have like, it's loaded. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of like mind games going on in it.
In the taxonomy of genres that interest you, the other week, and we're going to talk about The Head now, you said that everything goes wrong at an Antarctic
station. Top five for me. Yeah.
You've also recently mentioned other genres, including couples fighting.
Yep.
And things go topsy-turvy on a beach.
Yeah. I mean, like, just like we went to paradise and it was hell.
Okay. And then erotic thrillers, top five?
No, I don't think so. I find erotic thrillers to be like, they've kind of outworn their usefulness to me, I think, is a fair way to say it.
Did I say...
Like, have you seen five erotic thrillers? Do you need to see the sixth, is, I guess, my question.
Okay, what's your top erotic thriller?
That's a great question.
Sean Fennessy, erotic thrillers movie draft, you coward.
No, Sean and Amanda did an erotic thrillers
That's right. I think I tweeted that admonition at him back then, too.
I like Body Double. I like Basic Instinct.
Yeah.
Deja Vu, I think, is pretty erotic.
Last Seduction, remember that?
Yeah, of course.
That was a good movie.
Yeah.
Did I say last week that when I was thinking about your favorite genres, that I do think my favorite genre of film is extended family gather at a summer home for a weekend?
Yes.
Yeah, that's my favorite genre of movie.
Is that like Gosford Park?
You could maybe do that. I was thinking like Summer Hours, all of Ozu's movies.
You're in your Criterion bag.
Still Walking, I saw recently a Japanese film. It's just anytime families gather and talk about stuff over meals, secrets come out. Love that. That's my favorite genre of film.
Yeah, but I did finish The Head.
I wanted to ask you, because we called attention to The Head the other week. Antarctic thriller, really clever conceit, a lot of fun to talk about the first few episodes with you. And I did try to dip back in, and I got to tell you, I found it a struggle. Because
you found it the opposite of an erotic thriller.
I did. I still liked the conceit, and I wanted to know what was going on. But I would say that the dialogue does sound like it's been run through a Canary Island
There were
Iceland
a couple
filter.
Of times watching The Head where I couldn't tell if I was watching something dubbed.
Yes, even though it was mostly in English, other than it is a little bit in, as you said correctly, it was a little bit in Borgonese.
Yes, I found it very entertaining. You know, I think we're in the dog days of being inside. So I will give anything like a pretty long leash. So I watched, I watched this excitedly. Like I was really interested to see how it wound up. I don't feel like I can, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but there is, I think the twists are well earned and pretty amusing and pretty entertaining.
Okay. So you think I should do it?
I could just tell you what happens.
No. I've now establishing a new benchmark where I will spoil myself.
But you don't want me to do it.
No. Is that an erotic thriller? Are we sketching out the parameters? Is this consensual? Okay?
Hey, so I wanted to ask you the biggest story that happened last week. We were obviously recording with Ethan Hawke, so that was, we didn't really hit it on the Thursday show.
Mm.
Was the announcement that Donald Glover had signed this new overall deal at Amazon. And as the streamers have gotten up and running and have started to grind more stuff out, I feel like in the last 15 months, especially 20 months, especially, we've heard a lot of announcements of these overall deals. And we throw these words around and we expect everybody to kind of understand them. And maybe you do, maybe you don't. But I thought maybe it would be useful using the Donald Glover deal as an example. Mm-hmm. If you could kind of talk to our listeners a little bit about what an overall deal is. Because I think as we go on, these will start to gain a little bit of transactional significance the way like an NBA trade might, or the way, you know, just the casting news used to for these shows. I think seeing where people are landing, where they're setting up their shingles is kind of a fascinating development.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's certainly, like with many things, there's levels to them. But big picture, an overall deal is a deal that an artist, generally a writer slash producer, will sign with a studio, which puts them aligns them exclusively with that studio for all of their TV work. I guess you could also see one where it's for all of their work if it's the studio in question does TV and films, movies, but well, often right. one is carved out over the other. And they range dramatically. I am under an overall deal at UCP, but part of Universal. Mine was not announced in the trades, nor did it have a nine-figure price tag attached to it like Donald Glover's, nor should it have.
Did it have a carve-out for you to finish Atlanta, though?
Weirdly, I did ask for that, and it was denied, but I did get a carve-out to continue my starring role as Lando Calrissian in upcoming Star Wars adventures. From a artist, writer, producer, director perspective, you might want an overall deal is, first and foremost, obviously, job security. If you are working in television, you are generally paid in kind of a haphazard fashion, depending on your deliverables. Your deal for writing or producing a TV show might be dependent on, you know, a format document, then an outline, and then a script. And then if that script is accepted, and then revisions, and then if it goes to series, then your producing fee per episodes. If you are under an overall deal, you are paid a lump sum every month, and all of those other benchmarks that I mentioned are called charge-offs, basically,
okay,
against the overall value of the deal. So if you were incredibly prolific, potentially you could out-earn your overall deal and be paid on top of it if the amount of work you're doing for the studio goes far and beyond the number that they had agreed to pay you for a year, 2 years, or 3 years. Once you're getting into these mega deals, which generally happen only for the biggest stars or the biggest multi-hyphenates.
The Glovers, the J.J. Abrams over at Warner, HBO Max, yeah.
Well, I think there's even a tier beyond that. So for Donald Glover or Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who are starring together in Mr. and Mrs. Smith for Amazon, they are stars themselves and actors who also write and create their own vehicles and potentially create their own vehicles for others. When you get up to like the Shonda Rhimes, J.J. Abrams category, you're bringing an entire company
sure.
into your studio and under the rubric of your studio. And there's going to be a vast number of projects as well as a vast number of employees being folded in. This was significant to me for a number of reasons. One, I mean, we predicted it on the podcast the other
you
week.
You predicted it, yeah.
Yeah, but anything I say, we say, unless it's about erotic thrillers, in which case I feel like we should be very clear who's articulating what. You know, we don't know the particulars. We certainly don't know the status of Donald Glover's relationship with FX, which has been hugely mutually beneficial to them, mm-hmm. Or what Amazon was offering. I think you could safely say that in the pre-Disney merger days, Amazon could definitely outspend FX. Not necessarily the case today, but I don't really know who's cashing which checks within that large company. I think that clearly, first of all, couldn't have been too acrimonious because, as you said, he's about to go into production on seasons 3 and 4 in Atlanta, which means that Amazon will potentially be paying him while he's working on a show for someone else.
Sure.
Those seasons are going to get done. And clearly he has empire building dreams of his own. I mean, this hasn't officially been announced, but in the Variety story, that Kate Arthur wrote, the Hollywood Reporter story that broke the news, it said that it listed another project that was coming with him and listed Malia Obama as a staff writer.
I thought
writer
almost as significant, the most significant thing in here was that he was going to, I think, get his own channel within Amazon Prime.
Which was very interesting.
Yeah, I think new. I don't remember hearing about somebody else getting the, and I wonder whether it is a sign of things to come, whether or not HBO Max in the future would have the J.J. Abrams channel, or whether or not, you know, you would start to see Apple TV say, Steven Spielberg, here's $1 billion.
It,
executive
it's pretty
produce.
Smart. It doesn't cost them very much to just add something to their UI and have a button on it. Actually, I'm probably wrong. It probably costs them $50 million every time they change the shade of purple.
Like, this is something that we don't talk about a lot, is how these streaming services are being organized and the extent to which they're not being organized.
And I think that the question that emerges for me from Donald Glover leaving FX is, if it's purely a greener pastures, let's try something new, let's part as friends who created beautiful Emmy-winning work together, or they just simply outspent him or whatever, that's fine. And I have no reason to think otherwise. But it does open up a potential question of how does a talent like Donald Glover fit into the Disneyverse going forward? Mm-hmm. Now, Disney has been very, very careful about carving out FX as, and I think even probably investing in FX as a brand that distinguishes itself from the rest of the kid stuff, essentially, that Disney's in the business of making, right? Like FX on Hulu is basically separated twice. It's not just its own thing. It's its own thing on Hulu.
Yes.
So clearly they are still investing in more grown-up fare, but how far does that stretch? And how much of Donald Glover leaving has to do with him either not wanting to or not liking any deals that were offered to play Lando in the future, or how much of this has to do with the Deadpool script? It was supposed to be a Deadpool animated series that he was going to do for FX, and that never made it to air. It's interesting. You know, clearly he thought that there were more opportunities for him if he took this deal. It's very exciting as people who are fans of him, and his brother came along for the ride too with his own overall deal within this larger mega deal. So it's exciting. We should also say, for people who are fans of Atlanta, they're in pre-production now. Season 3 and 4 are being shot concurrently. There is a carve out in the deal, not just for season 3 and 4, but if he ever wants to return
to it. Go back and do it. Yeah. And maybe he'll turn Atlanta into something that, while not as prolific, is something similar to what the folks who do another FX show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, do, which is essentially just saying, like, why would we ever end this? You know, and that was those guys have been really open about talking to, like, Larry David about Curb and just being like, just don't stop. Like, you can do it in all these different ways, but if you like doing it with each other, don't throw that away. And if they want to keep making Atlanta, they could come back to it every 2 or 3 years if they wanted to. They could make a standalone movie or something like that.
And I think the other thing that I would say is the mega, mega deals that Netflix has made over the last few years, particularly people point to the Ryan Murphy and the Shonda Rhimes one.
Right.
Those were really smart. They were really smart, period. But they were also really smart from a content perspective, because those two people make TV shows. You know what I mean? And they make TV shows that get eyeballs and get attention and get awards. But they are also in the volume business, which is what Netflix is also in. So it might be interesting to watch if Amazon seeks to distinguish itself by being in the personality business, for lack of a better term. If they invest in the Phoebe Waller-Bridges and the Donald Glovers and the sort of hyper-talented multi-hyphenates who maybe only make one show a year if that's what tickles their fancy, but that one show is going to drive conversation. Amazon has limitless money and can do that because they're also spending quarter bill on Lord of the Rings. So they can have it both ways.
It's interesting. We were talking about the UI experience, and I think we've knocked certain companies for being late arriving to the table as a streamer. We've sort of needled different services for not having their shit together on opening day, or their library is really hard to navigate. And, you know, in terms of Netflix now, I feel like it's almost exclusively the newest of the new stuff is there, and it's hard to find anything that they have in terms of library. But Amazon, actually, for as much stuff as they do that I like, is still the most inscrutable of all of these services in terms of, you have to go find this stuff. Like, just the video offerings, one, you know, there are different ways to watch Amazon, obviously, and they're, in some ways, it's much more elegant. I think on certain services, you can kind of see all the channels. It's another one of those things that aggregates some of your other pay cable channels so that you can watch Stars or HBO or Sundance or whatever. But at least on the browser and, like, in a couple of different ways, it takes a little bit of work to find what you're looking for on Amazon. And so I wonder whether or not they are recognizing that by being like, we're going to give this person a channel. We're going to allow them to have a little bit of influence over the skin of this thing and how it looks and how it feels.
Yeah, I think that also speaks to something that we've been chattering about for a while, which is I do think that a turn toward curation is in the future for a lot of these services. I think that that's been an undervalued part of it. And I think in the push to decentralize your programming choices and your evening's entertainment, something has been slightly lost. And actually, you know, shepherding some things in a more useful way will be interesting. And you can start to see that, not necessarily in terms of personality-driven channels yet, but on HBO Max, on Peacock, the categories are becoming a little more bespoke, you know, or a little more designed around the time of year it is or where the conversation might be culturally or whatever. And I think that's probably a helpful thing.
Before we get to WandaVision, I just thought I would shout out Hope Davis is got announced today that she would be playing Sandy. Is it Sandy Dennis?
Sandy Furness.
Sandy Furness. Who's Sandy Dennis? Sandy... Sandy Dennis, the folk singer.
Who Sandy Duncan was the star of the Hogan Family.
That's right. Anyway, Sandy Furness, Hope Davis will be playing his daughter on the season 3 of Succession, which seems to be up and running and in production. And I have fingers crossed that we will see it around the time that it would normally be released, which is August.
I am 1,000,000% here for this. I demand someone out there take the Shepherd Fairey Obama poster and just put Hope on the Hope poster because I love Hope Davis.
How long were you working on that?
I Googled it before we started podcasting. I was like, someone must have done this.
Right.
Some New York City theater stand must have done this already. Isn't love Hope Davis, in, back to the Day Trippers.
Isn't she in the Marvel Universe as like Natasha Romanoff's like tutor at one point in Ultra? Like, isn't Hope Davis like working in the orphanage that raises Black Widow?
How dare you? Don't make me Google this while we're recording. I mean, my God.
Should I vamp?
Hope Davis played Maria Stark in Captain America: Civil War.
Okay.
Is that his mom?
Yeah, I guess so. So who played the woman in the orphanage in Ultron?
Can we just talk about the fact that Downey's parents in this movie are Slattery and Hope Davis?
Yeah.
We should be so lucky. Wait, before we get off on the Black Widow tangent, I just want to say, not only is this exciting, she's a great actress and she should work all the time. And yes, before anyone mentions it, I know she's in the Bryan Cranston Showtime show that neither of us watched. Sorry, but I'm excited to watch her in Succession.
Speaking of spoiling things, I really enjoyed reading the recaps of the finale of that show.
Ooh, well, maybe I'll look into that, but not because you told me to, because I chose to. I am really excited for Succession to fill a very, very specific lane, which is just scooping up and casting all the great New York actors who are hanging around, especially now that there's no theater happening. Already, you know, she's playing Sandy Furness's daughter. That's the daughter of Larry Pine, a classic that guy who's basically in like every theater production that's at least one show every season in New York. I think there's a lot of room on
this
road.
Who are some of the people that you would like to see come into the... I think that what we're really looking at is the final big bad. Well, obviously, like Logan is the big bad, but the final boss is Stanley Tucci for me.
Wow. You want Tucci there?
When he gets done with his trip around the globe, like he comes back to New York and does Succession.
Oh, I want Crude up on this show.
Oh, yeah. But don't you feel like the morning show is kind of like in the Succession universe already?
Yeah, but I don't watch it. So I'm just talking, we're just specifically focused on my needs right now.
You want Crude up and we got Tucci. Who would be another draft pick?
From the New York theater community?
Yeah.
Well, let me just go through the playbill I have of the production of Coast of Utopia I saw at Lincoln Center in 2006.
Who is the lady who's like in all the revivals? Is it Kelly something? She's in like King and I and stuff.
Kelly O'Hara?
Yeah. Let's get her in it.
Kelly O'Hara would be great. That'd be dynamite. I love this. Let's shout out to all the Watch Theater heads. You are not well served on this podcast, but we do our best.
They're better served on this podcast than they are on any other Ringer podcast.
That's fair. Before we move on, you mentioned it before. Let's just call attention to the fact that two great shows of the 21st century that were lost unfairly to streaming are now both on HBO Max, where they always should have been. And these were the Cinemax originals, The Nick and Banshee. And
iCarly. Yeah. No, sorry.
And finally, speaking of erotic thrillers, Cinemax had a lot to offer.
Cinemax,
this last century.
I mean, like, you know, their brief moment as prestige TV aside, for most of my life, Cinemax has either been Skinemax or it's been where like guys break one another's legs.
Why can't it be both?
I know, right?
Usually one leads to the other in the hothouse environment of Cinemax. quick backstory here. As Chris was saying, Cinemax was like the extra channel for people who don't even remember cable that you could also, for an extra fee on your HBO subscription, you could get. And they showed movies during the day, and then they showed a different kind of movie later at night.
Yeah.
In the last decade, as prestige television was exploding, there was an effort within HBO to begin promoting original programming on Cinemax, and started with a show like Strike Back, which is, you know, kind of a ripped action show that was well made, but it was basically trying to skiff on the same kind of vibes that it had been. Things turbocharged a bunch of years ago when Steven Soderbergh directed The Nick, starring Clive Owen, premiered on Cinemax. We've covered this before. The reason the show was on Cinemax was because it was in development at HBO, and they, but the development pipeline at HBO, because they only programmed for Sunday nights, was notoriously clogged up and slow. And Soderbergh is like, I don't do slow. I'm going to do this now, or I'm not going to do it at all. And so they shunted it to Cinemax. Two brilliant seasons. One of the best medical shows in history. One of the best period shows in history. This is two seasons of television directed by one of our greatest living directors, with mind-blowing performances from Clive Owen and Andre Holland. And, you know, I think if you know, you know. If you don't, you didn't have Cinemax or you weren't aware of it. And it's just should be, it should be here to be seen, particularly because it might not even be over, because Soderbergh, as we reported last year, well, we didn't break the story, but we talked about it on the podcast, has basically gifted the franchise to Barry Jenkins with the hopes of resurrecting it with Andre Holland's character and with the original guys who wrote the show. That could be thrilling, but you'd be hard pressed to find better TV to watch at this moment if you haven't seen it than The Nick. And
it can feel very overwhelming to keep up with television. I would just say that The Nick is better than most of what's on right now. And, you know, one of the cool things that you see happen recently is that, just especially in the Netflix top 10, like this random thing will show up in the top 10. You know, sometimes it's Den of Thieves or whatever, but like, and I love Den of Thieves, but sometimes it's something, you know, just kind of like from that recent nostalgia era, like something from the last 10 years, and somehow it catches an algorithmic wave and it just winds up getting in front of a lot of people. I hope that starts to happen more often with some of the shows that Andy and I talk about that have been a little bit lost to time. Maybe they were cut short a little too prematurely, or maybe like not enough people knew about it. And, you know, I hope that the Nick winds up finding a bigger audience than it did maybe the first time around. It's a little bit challenging for sure, but it's some of the best filmmaking you'll see on television.
And then not on a separate note in terms of quality, but definitely in terms of content and also what it was going for, Banshee, one of my favorite shows. If you like Den of Thieves, you probably would like Banshee. If you like erotic thrillers, you would like Banshee.
Tom Pelfrey from Ozark is on it. Yeah.
In later seasons. Anthony Starr is the star. From, you know him as Boys. Homelander on The Boys. It is pure pulp. It is just sort of absolutely without shame, down and dirty entertainment, crazy violence, crazy fight scenes, and about a unnamed criminal who impersonates the sheriff in a just existentially corrupt small Pennsylvania town. It's a blast. And I know people have been clamoring for us to cover what I might end up being the last Cinemax original show, a show called Warrior, that was created by Jonathan Tropper, who is also the co-creator and was eventually the sole showrunner of Banshee. So if you've missed that link in the development of your favorite action TV shows, check it out. The only thing I'm holding out hope for, and I'll just say it loud and proud again, is Quarry, which I think is the best pulp noir show maybe ever on TV. A one season wonder, should have been many more. Hopefully HBO Max throws that up there soon.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about WandaVision.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on cars.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
All right, brother, like we do every Monday, we're going to break down the last episode, the most recent episode of WandaVision. This was the Modern Family Office episode. This is the Breaking the Fourth Wall episode. This is Elizabeth Olsen going full Julie Bowen episode. And I thought we could start our conversation. This is going to be a spoilerific talk about what happens in this episode. So if you haven't gotten a chance to watch it, just wait until you do. But I wanted to start off this episode with a tweet from our old buddy Mark Harris, who is obviously one of the great cultural critics, and just somebody that Andy and I admire quite a bit. And
biographer of Mike Nichols, new book out now. Here's a plug.
Yeah. And he sent out a tweet a couple days ago where he said, "So the big reveal in the newest WandaVision episode is something that is comprehensible to only to people who are so deeply versed in Marvel that, judging from Twitter, they all guessed well in advance. Doesn't seem ideal." I thought this would be an interesting jumping off point because obviously, the quote-unquote twist of this episode was the Catherine Hahn character has orchestrated this entire thing, and that she is the big bad, or at least like initially what we think will be the big bad. She is in a montage during her theme song. It was Agatha All Along, which is a lot of fun. We basically see all these cut scenes of her, you know, swirling around magic to make Wanda do this or Vision do that, or to make the kids do this or make Pietro show up at her door. And this is something that I think goes back to what we were talking about with spoilers, where you were like, I've read these books. I kind of know where they're mm-hmm. going. And so this will probably, I'm sure that this episode came as no surprise to you. I will say, without giving anything away, and we could still see this, the drumbeat on the streets was a lot louder than it's Agatha. You know, the drum, like, I think that there was an expectation that there was going to be a slightly more significant twist or reveal. I think there still might be. Yeah, we still got two more episodes. But let's talk a little bit about this. Did you find this twist, so to speak, fun, disappointing? What did you even consider a twist, since you probably knew it was happening anyway?
I agree with Mark's tweet. I mean, I all the caveats that we've been saying about the show apply. Elizabeth Olsen was great. Mm-hmm. She did a great Julie Bowen. Catherine Hahn is delightful. The show's, Matt Shakman, the director, deserves credit for this especially. The show's mastery at this stage in its run of the different, quite discordant pieces.
Visual languages, yeah.
Is really something. You know, I thought maybe more so than earlier in the season when they were starting to merge the worlds. This one, it didn't feel like they were pieced together from different shows. It felt all of a piece, even though what's going on outside of the Hex or outside of Westview is obviously different from what's going on inside of it. All of that is true. There were moments of actual pathos and charm and wit and pleasure to be found in the episode. But ultimately, I did find myself totally perplexed by what it was all for. Specifically, to Mark's point, what does this mean to anybody who hasn't read the comic books but has taken a liking to these characters and their, you know, fascinating connection to each other and significance to the larger Marvel Cinematic Universe. Who is really checking for it to be a witch that they didn't know about? You know what I mean? It's very bizarre to me, and it reminded me of something that I'm not proud of, but I'm going to admit on this podcast because it's just us, which is a couple weeks ago, in a bored moment, I was sort of flipping around on my phone, and I found an old app, an endless runner game called Subway Surfers that I downloaded in like 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And by God,
that's still on your phone from 2012?
Yeah, like on the sixth page of apps or whatever. And by God, if I didn't slip, like a junkie who thinks you can like just one more hit. And for a couple days, I was like, boy, I'm accomplishing a lot here. And then I remembered there's no accomplishment. It just is a simulacrum of accomplishment where you get coins and you feel like you've advanced somehow, maybe a high score or a new character. But it's just the same thing over and over and over. And that is part of the charm and part of its insidious appeal. And it kind of left me with the same empty feeling that this episode did. Because yes, there are two episodes to go. Yes, it's masterfully done. But I don't know, especially because it is so, again, to Mark's point, and I'm impressed that he was able to make, he was so efficient in his expression of disbelief. He used 260 characters or so, and I'm still talking, that it seems equally unsatisfying on both ends of it, which is to say that from the season premiere, I think I mentioned that the character of Agnes was oddly similar to a character that was important to the development of Scarlet Witch called Agatha Harkness. The internet was way ahead of this, of course, too, and talking about it and explaining it. So if you already knew it was coming, what is it, just a pat yourself on the back moment? And if you didn't know it was coming, what do you care? It's a strange exercise. And maybe this is the moment or the beginning of the moment when my own personal relationship with the MCU gets challenged a little bit, because I'm just feeling week to week, and I may have even said this last week, so it's becoming a week to week deja vu trapped in Westview of my mind for you guys, that there was something particularly useful about going to the movies, having 2 hours of like, yeah, mm-hmm. and then never thinking about it again until the next movie. Now that we are taking our week to week prestige discourse and applying it to a Marvel event movie, essentially, it's leaving me wanting.
The way that they're doing these episodes, where each one has this sort of distinct feel because of the homage it's paying towards whatever decade of television that it's being sort of reverential about, makes, I think, us feel like these episodes are more episodic than they are. I noticed kind of the way that this episode was laid out. While it had a twist ending, it was essentially like 20 minutes from the late second act of a movie. You know, it didn't really have like a beginning, middle, and end. I didn't necessarily think that in traditional terms, the way you kind of think of an episode is having maybe a little bit of thematic cohesion as well as like obvious visual cohesion. It's just kind of like 3 yards in a pile of dirt, New York Giants, 1980 style offense, where you just like hand it off to Joe Morris and you get a couple of yards downfield and then you're like, okay, we did it, first down. And that will probably be lost on most people who are really deep into WandaVision, but you get my drift. Let me ask you this. So one of the things that I like to do is watch WandaVision and then immediately kind of start reading about what I just watched. And that scholarship is sort of divorced from the show, I think. So I found out that I got this from, I think, the Screen Rant does these weekly Easter egg videos. And the guy who does them mentioned that the date that Agatha says is her anniversary to this never seen Ralph is the same day that the Salem witch trial started.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a hard time believing that they're going to have time to get into that. I mean, maybe next week, if they do like a long monologue of exposition with her, she'll mention it. But that's the kind of thing that gives you this weird sugar rush of like, oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, well, I don't really know what that effectively changes about my appreciation of the character or the show or anything. I mean, like, they are very good at layering shit in and then showing just enough so that someone will make an Easter eggs video about it or will be able to unpack it. But I'm not so sure if it really changes how I felt about the show at all. It's just an interesting added benefit to going along on this every week rather than, oh, like, if you read about like why they chose this person's character name on Lost and then read the biblical story of that character, you understand that they might be the original something something. And I know that like, I'm not trying to say like it was cool when Lost did it, but it's kind of corny now. But I do think it's like they've kind of tapped into this ability to be engaged with something that almost is free of the text completely.
Well, I'll speak to the Lost point, which I think is a really good one and a good distinction to make. Regardless of what you felt about Lost or ultimately felt about Lost, there were stakes in Lost because they were original characters heading towards a conclusion one way or another. And so to go deep into the text, and whether it means you, you know, start reading about John Locke and Hume and all the philosophers that were mentioned or the Egyptian mythology, did all of it add up to something? Not necessarily, but all of it influenced our understanding of the characters and allowed us to make predictive games or hopes or suppositions about where these people who we become invested in might end up. In Marvel, the noise is the signal. It's all noise, mm-hmm. you know, and there's so much of it to draw from. Agatha Harkness in the comic books is a witch who was around in Salem, you know, and has a connection to a character that a lot of Marvel fans want to show up, who is literally the devil. Mm-hmm. Mephisto. They want Mephisto involved in this.
So is that Ralph? And
maybe. Could be. What does it change if it is or it isn't? I think from a macro perspective, I'll say something that I think we've articulated before or tried to, which is I wholeheartedly support and even enjoy Kevin Feige and the rest of the brain trust at Marvel's commitment to the most bonkerballs corners of their comic book universe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a version of this opportunity to make a TV show where they say, well, we have these two Avengers characters, let's just have them have more Avengers adventures. And instead, they are steering right into the skid, which is that over her 60-year history of publication, the Scarlet Witch has been a evil mutant, an Avenger, a actual witch, you know, with connections to the actual devil, and back again. So kudos to them for embracing all of it. That's what good comic book storytelling often can do. But it's not leading us to any kind of finite place. It's leading us into the next one, like an mm-hmm. Endless Runner app on your phone, which is a type of entertainment that we should, which I was used to in the 80s and 90s as a comic book fan. And I think we should all get used to now.
Get familiar with it. You mentioned the movie experience and the feeling that you have when you go into one of these things and it's like there's an exit there. You get out and you like say, oh, that was great. Can't wait for six more months or nine more months and I'll see another one. I found that was nagging at me a little bit with some of the science of this episode. I think in the movies, when they're like, we have to lift Sokovia up and then stop it from getting dropped on the ground, or we have to take it up even higher, or whatever the fuck happens in that movie, you're just kind of like, yeah, this is so loud and big. I'm not going to spend too much time thinking about it. For some reason, when Monica drove that truck and was just like, I can get it through, and then the truck gets thrown out, and like they built the truck overnight, essentially, like, it's just like, what are you talking about? Like, what are you like, I was just kind of like, I'm not like a truck guy or a sphere guy or anything like that, but I was just sort of like, isn't there this for as elaborate as all these other references are to all these different things in both the real world and in the MCU? Sometimes they still have like pretty goofy ass action sequences or just like physical sequences.
Oh, my favorite part was when the FBI agent who has no attachment whatever to the special government space unit that's controlling the situation started barking orders at the space truck as it went into the extra dimensional whatever.
That being said, I do think that it's been cool to see what I have to imagine is the last few times we'll see Bettany as Vision. I mean, you know, no one ever really dies in these things, but like, I feel like it's definitely setting us up for Well, I mean, he doesn't exist outside of this place, right?
Yeah, but she can change reality. I mean, I think that what we're opening up...
Aren't we learning that that's not a good thing?
Well, but we are also at the cusp of the next era of Marvel filmed entertainment where extra dimensional shit is just normal. And the ad in this episode was for Nexus pills, and that is, I guess, a reference to a more past my time comic book thing, which was that certain characters are themselves nexi of realities and can pluck things and be aware of multiple timelines or dimensions at the same
time.
Scarlet Witch is one of them. No, but what they're gonna do
It's no, but are people going to be like, first of all, cool, there's three Scarlet Witches and there's like one world in which Vision is still alive?
First of all, don't you think that all bloggers should just be sending thank you cards to the show? Because like Marvel's putting this stuff out here and is single-handedly now, Disney is propping up the old school blog economy that like a website can be like, here's the 19 things you missed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like that is content driving. So respect, we're talking about it. I think that I definitely don't think Paul Bettany's done doing this. I think that maybe it might feel like it for another episode or two. It might feel like it at the end of this season, but I think that there's clearly demand for it. I would also say this is, I'll preface this by saying I don't think this was ever in play or a possibility, but there is a moment when Feige could have made a more, I think, creatively fascinating choice. It would have probably been a catastrophic choice for the economics of the world dominating brand that is Marvel. But there was a version of this where when they steered to small screen and smaller stories, they could have made a Wanda and Vision show that kind of drilled down on the really bizarre psychological thing that underpins this, which is a robot without feelings is the absolute object of adoration and love from a very 60s era comic book character who is just the manifestation of hysterical emotional feelings, who can, just by being upset about something, can warp reality.
Right.
And that's fertile ground that TV would love to do something with, but it faints towards that stuff. It winks at it. You know, Elizabeth Olsen's performance is getting really nuanced and strange and strong and carries pieces of that, but ultimately it's movie
spectacle. Like we sound down on this show.
We do, because, but that's for me.
But we sound down or are we down?
Well, I think it's both. I think that, am I happy that it exists every week to talk about and to watch and to see what they're going to do next? Yes. Yeah. I'm not pretending I'm immune to it. It's so well made. I like this stuff. Mm-hmm. When it was revealed that it was Agatha Harkness, I didn't roll my eyes. I went, oh, okay, they did it. You know, I'm engaged. But I don't find, in terms of conversation about it, I just don't think there's much there in terms of like the more emotional character-based stuff.
Yeah, I think we have been asked
a
couple
of
times, like, why aren't you guys actually like talking about what you see on screen? And I think that the way we're having this conversation, albeit very meta, maybe sometimes repetitive, is still like what we're seeing on screen. I don't really know that you need us to go through beat by beat and be like, it was real funny when they punched the guy at the circus and get in the truck. And it was also really funny when she builds this, like she has the crew go out and work on the stoplight and then the kids cross. And the idea that there's part of her mind that is trying to stop Vision from getting back to her because that will probably end this whole charade.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could talk about the birth of a new hero in Monica Rambeau, I guess, beginning to become...
So she's Photon or Spectrum?
I mean, I guess, I don't know if they've decided yet.
Right.
But she's on her way to becoming an Avenger or whatever she's going to be.
So we can end by asking you this. Andy, the guy who loves watching this show, or doesn't, but like is watching this show.
Joe Sixpack.
What's the save here? Is it blow my fucking mind with the next phase of the MCU coming off the top rope and now we know what's going on and Ralph is Mephisto and like it's just like we know the new villain of the next 5 years of our lives? Is it Kramer versus Kramer with these two people like being like we can't be together because like even if it's good for us or good for me, it's bad for all these other people. There's no way to do it safely. I can't manifest you back into the real world without basically taking over the minds of all these people in this town. Or is it, I don't know. I mean, cause we're kind of at the moment where it's like the last two episodes would stand to reason would be a Marvel movie. I don't think that they don't have that many more TV tropes to pay homage to.
Right. I mean, there are two paths diverging for these last two episodes and there's a version of it. And I'm not saying this is the version that I want, but there is a version of it where it goes full, like they should have hired Derek Cianfrance to direct Michelle Williams in it, where a woman realizes that her children are fictional, the devil is real, and her husband is dead and always has been. And now she has to live in New Jersey for the rest of her life. like, although shops in New Jersey, they just legalized weed, so maybe that would help mitigate things. They're not going to do that show. You know, it's okay. We should all admit that. I guess what I'm continuing to struggle with is that the show and the people making it are so smart and they're so good at what they're doing that they wink towards that show. It's like the simulacrum of that show. There will be some of that emotion brimming in Elizabeth Olsen's incredibly expressive eyes. But ultimately, yeah, it's just going to do a handoff to whatever's coming next. And I think what would surprise me is that if the finale did something like what you're alluding to, like I still think this is just a relatively small bore early entry into their TV expansion. I don't think Thanos is going to be in a post-credit sequence or Thanos 2.0.
I hope not.
You know what I mean? But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this will, there will be a puppet master behind the scenes, not the actual Marvel character, the puppet master, who will build slowly over the next few things into the next few movies. And as we've said when we started talking about the show, we actually don't know still what the next phase is because there were no movies this year.
Yeah.
And they've been...
They had to shuffle their deck.
And they play these things so well, they don't need to tell us because everyone's doing their work for them, getting hype about what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, at this point, what do you think the reaction would be if John Krasinski didn't show up at some point wearing Lycra suit with a four emblazoned on the chest?
Like, I think people would be disappointed.
We are at the stage where actually, because of the lack of films and the lack of direction from HQ, the fan community has gone past, has advanced on the board past where reality is in terms of the reality, like actually filmed entertainment. And so now the expectations, I mean, yeah, you got your Agatha Harkness. We got that one. But unless...
He's the engineer that I was talking about. He was the person that she was texting. I was sort of surprised when they got to the field where the truck was waiting. And I thought that that we were kind of building up to Reed Richards brings the truck right out. And it's just like, look what I built for you. And instead it was, you know, some other soldier.
You know what the other thing is? It'll be interesting to see. Here's something that I'm looking for. It doesn't have to be the big villain for the next few movies, but I will be very, very curious to see if they pull the trigger on introducing a major film cornerstone on a TV show. Has that barrier broken? Is that meaningless now?
No, you're right.
You know what
you're
I mean?
Right.
That would mean, in a weird way, that would be so crazily significant because they don't, you know, they took back the X-Men characters and the Fantastic Four characters, but in terms of like major A-list heroes that have not been introduced, okay, yes, all of the X-Men. But other than that, the biggest one remaining is Fantastic Four and what they would do with them. I just don't think you burn that reveal in episode 7 of your first TV show, but maybe that's old thinking.
Maybe this is all we're overthinking it, and Brie Larson just flies out of the sky and tells Monica that her mom always loved her, you know, like or something. But like I really don't know.
But that happens in Captain Marvel too, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're right.
This kind of. And this is ultimately
I know
probably
this is crazy, but this kind of
back.
Reminds me of like when magazines first started websites and they would kind of argue about who would do what. You know what I mean? Can we do a top 40 if you're doing a top 40? And it's
or
like
at Spin, we did both.
Yeah, but I know that that's like an incredibly self-involved way of looking at it. But like, trust me, for as much as they're saying TV is where we're going, the streaming is where we're going. There's going to have to be at some point, someone's going to say like, yeah, like I signed up to do 9 movies, you know, or we want to save this for the Hulk movie, not She-Hulk the show, or we want to save this for Captain Marvel 2. You know, I think that's going to be an issue.
I also think that it is telling. When people say, why aren't we talking about like the plot? I think we're talking about the most interesting stuff about the show, which still, for me, remain the corporate and creative machinations and storytelling decisions behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated in it. I think it's really cool and really interesting and worth paying attention
also,
to.
Also, just think about
how they're moving the chess pieces on the game board. What happens within the chess pieces, I don't have an emotional connection to it. I have to be honest with you. I love seeing the stories unfold.
All this stuff has changed just so drastically since Mandalorian came out, and specifically since the second season of Mandalorian came out. I think that the idea of seeing a character of the stature of Luke Skywalker just like walk onto a streaming television show after he had died, you know, everything is up for grabs now. And so nothing would shock me. It wouldn't shock me if Steve Rogers is in Falcon the Winter Soldier. It wouldn't shock me if anything could happen in the next two episodes of this show. But I can't believe, like, this is one of those things where they're like, you know, for thousands of years, we just rode horses or walked. And then, like, in 25 years, we were taking bullet trains. It was like, that's how I feel like on TV, where it's like, yeah, 5 years ago, this was like impossible. Nobody, and we were only just starting to be like, Matthew McConaughey does television. What a world. And now we're fucking going towards like, this is all going to be the same thing. And how they dole out these major plot points that they're sitting on and these characters that they're developing is going to be really, 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 really fascinating.
But I am still waiting to see the full commitment to integration. I'm waiting to see, like, I actually don't care if they do it. I guess I'm curious to see if they will do it. And what I mean by that is when Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. premiered, like, 8 years ago or whenever that was, there was a lot of talk that this was absolutely in the movie universe. Here's Agent Coulson, who you remember from the movies. And now that show, well, very successful in its own right, did fall prey to the intramural squabbling between Marvel TV and the movies. And basically they had to just, ultimately, all they could ever do was say, boy, that was crazy, that thing that happened. Let's swoop in and clean up the damage. Mm-hmm. Like, there really wasn't any overlap. It was storytelling spackle between the movies. And though much has changed, and we're dealing with the actual characters now, who we also see in the movies, I think in terms of moving the storytelling ball forward, I don't know. We might still be in that same pattern. And, for example, we haven't seen Falcon and Winter Soldier yet. We're going to see it next month. My guess is it's kind of a series about the legacy of Steve Rogers and Captain America and who deserves to carry the shield. And neither of those dudes are going to become Captain America during the series, unless it happens at the very last scene of the very last episode, setting up Sebastian Stan or Anthony Mackie's debut as Captain America in the next big movie.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Of course.
None of this devalues it, but I guess all this is to say, I like playing Endless Runners too. I just feel a little bit hollow-eyed and vacant after I play them for a long time.
We can wrap it up there. I think we're going to probably talk about Nomadland on Thursday. If people haven't got a chance to check it out, they should do so on Hulu. We'll also talk about some other stuff. It's great to see you as always.
Is Nomadland a Eternals prequel officially? Nomad, by the way, a character from the Captain America.
Does he do a lot of work with Puppet Master?
They've been known to squabble,
yeah,
on occasion. Yeah, I'm going to send you some JPEGs of Puppet Master.
Please do.
So you know.
All right, talk to you soon, man.
Great job, Franski.